You are listening to Retronauts, a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. To hear more great shows, or to learn how you could become part of our consortium of independently owned podcasts, check out greenlitpodcasts.com. This week in Retronauts, I was a teenage Atari rioter, or something like that. Anyway, hi everyone. Welcome to Retronauts episode. Whoa, I didn't look it up. It's got big numbers next to it. It's it would actually
800.
No, it's not episode 800. But if this were an 8-bit podcast, we would definitely be way past the buffer overflow at this point. So this is episode like negative 20. Okay, it's episode 389. That's a lot of podcasts. I am Jeremy Parrish, counting beyond 255. And here, also incrementing with me, we have the locals from Retronauts East. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Let's introduce ourselves. Let's see. We'll go with the guy who is the star of this episode, the one who's going to be carrying us all on his back, kind of like Jesus in that, you know, that poem about the footprints.
Exactly.
Ben, just carry us along the beach where there is only one set of tracks.
Hi, I'm Ben Edwards. I am now associate editor of How To Geek.
Da, 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 da. Wow. Who do you associate with? Like, are you hobnobbing?
Everybody. Yeah.
I'm excellent. All right.
And next is...
I'm Ben Elton. I'm along for the ride. I was alive when this stuff was going on. That's my qualification.
Yeah, me too. This really is Binge's episode. But it's something he was insistent on talking about at some point. And I said, okay, Binge... let's go for it. It's all on you now. No pressure or anything. But yes, this episode we are talking about the Atari 8-bit family, which I've learned a great deal from about recently in researching for this episode, thanks to the work of one guy named Benj Edwards, who wrote a really great retrospective on the Atari 8-bit family for Fast Company. And you may not have heard of Fast Company, but it's like Bad Company, but faster. So the Atari 8-bit family, when I say that, what I mean specifically are the computer platforms, which were numbered all the way from 400 to like 1600.
There were 1200.
There was a 1400 also.
Well, that never came out.
Really. Oh, did it not? Okay. The 1400 XL. It's hard to keep track. They had so many numbers. It was kind of like Macintosh models back in the 90s. Just like, what? Like there's some logic to it. But it's confusing. But also, in addition to the computers, there's the hybrid XEGS. And we're going to talk about the Atari 5200 because it's almost a part of the Atari 8-bit family of computers, but not quite, but close enough. And there's just not enough to the 5200 to really carry its own episode. So it's getting lumped in here because it was the little system that couldn't, but it almost could. So with that in mind, let's talk about very briefly our own experiences with the Atari 8-bit family. Ben, let's start with you, Mr. Elgin.
So, yeah, I don't have a lot of direct experience, definitely not with the 8-bit computers themselves. In that era, I had the TI-99/4A, which we already talked about in a different episode. We didn't have an Atari computer at
home. I didn't know
home.
People outside of Texas actually used TI-99/4As.
Yeah,
something new every day.
Well, you learned it like a year or two ago when we did.
I know, but then coronavirus happened and I forgot everything. Like life just reset a few months ago.
But yeah, so that was the console computer hybrid that I had. But I did play some of this era's Atari games on I think it was the kids of a college friend of my parents had an Atari. And I think they may have actually had a 5200. Because I remember playing some Atari games that looked, like a little more than the earlier Ataris could do. Like in particular, it had a kind of vamped up version of Centipede on it that had, I think, better graphics than actually both the 2600 and the 8-bit version. the PC version.
That would be 5200 version was different than the 800 version. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, so for myself, I have like no experience with the Atari 8-bit family. Almost no experience. My one meaningful experience was that when I was a kid, the Atari 400 system computer was one of those things that my father brought home, like as a secondhand thing. I don't know exactly how this happened. You know, he worked in schools, and my grandparents were managers, like live-in resident managers at a dormitory at a men's dormitory at a local college. So sometimes things that were just kind of left behind would trickle their way into our home. That's how we got our Pong system, our Coleco Telstar.
So like where other families would bring home lost puppies, your dad would bring
home lost. Yeah, he's like, here's some electronics. Can you make it work? And the thing about the Atari 400 was that I could not make it work. And that's because like it I could plug it in. I could hook it up to the TV. I could get a signal. But I couldn't make it do anything, and I was positive that it was just like defective. But I was trying to use Atari 2600 cartridges on it, because that was when you could buy, you know, 2600 cartridges for a buck, or like five for a buck in a bin full of games just piled up in a convenience store, because they were just like, get this the hell out of our home or out of our store. So, of course, a 2600 cartridge would work on it. So I tried programming on it, but, you know, I didn't realize that it used its own version of, like, ProDOS. So I couldn't get that to work. So I just thought it was, you know, defective. But it wasn't really possible to just, you know, go online and look up information on how to make this thing work at the time. So I was just a kid trying to figure out how to use a computer with no manual. So that was it. That was my disappointment. I was so excited about like, oh, I can do some stuff with this, but I couldn't even make, you know, like a Hello World program work. So it was kind of pathetic. So basically my experience with the Atari 400 is a prompt, like a text prompt on the screen.
With you is that the 400 needed a basic cartridge to be programmable. Otherwise it goes to the Atari computer memo pad right when you start it up and you just type random things on it. It doesn't do anything.
That would explain why nothing executes. Okay.
Yeah. So you need the basic cartridge, and that's what you need.
Programming memos to yourself.
God damn it. So that was my sad experience. But like, how was I supposed to know any of that? I was, you know, probably like 7 or 8 years old. And again, there just wasn't the information out there, and I didn't have any money that I could go like buy a book or something. So it was
useless.
And then, you know, the Atari 5200. I remember seeing, like, in stores, and I had a friend who had it, and I just remember, like, there was something that felt more advanced about it beyond the graphics. Like, he had, you know, boxed games for it on his you know, VHS tape shelf, and I was like, oh, wow, those just look more sophisticated. They look better than 2600 games. Like, the silver packaging, you know, everything was just, like, very advanced. I always really loved the Atari computer lineups packaging for games. It just has this really super classy style with like the Optima typeface, and there's like, you know, kind of the bottom box area that's flat and has like the title of the program or the game, and then there's a kind of a flat space at the top that has some of the branding in it, but then in the middle there's artwork, and it just looks so good. It's so like quintessentially 80s classy. But I never actually got to own those things. So the closest I came was like typing some basic commands into the notepad. So that's my story. And I probably could have said that in like 30 seconds, but we got to kill time. We got to fill time just in case, you know, just in case things don't work out this episode.
Just in case I forgot everything about the Atari because I only got 6 hours of sleep last night.
That's right. So yeah. So I'm giving you some padding here, Benj.
Yeah, thanks.
So all of that was just a vapid preamble to the real meat. Not that your contribution was vapid, Ben. Just mine. Mine was extremely drawn out. Okay, I'm going to stop digressing here and just let Benj talk about his own experiences with the Atari 8-bit family, because I know it's a platform that's near and dear to his heart, and he has a lot of formative memories of it. So, Benj, take it away.
Yeah, the 8-bit family is like part of my family in a way. My dad bought his first Atari 800 for my brother in 1981, the year I was born, probably just before I was born or just after I was born. And so I've had an Atari in the house for 40 years. And the funny thing is I still have that Atari 800, and my brother still has one. We got another one later. And of course, me collecting, I have tons of them now. But anyway, the funny thing is I grew up watching my brother play the Atari 800. We always called it the 800. I think the story was that my dad first bought an Atari 400 for my brother, but my brother was frustrated with it because of the keyboard, and my dad really wanted him to learn programming on it. So he returned that and got an Atari 800 and a disk drive, and it was a lot of money back then. I found the receipt for the disk drive somewhere. It's really cool. I think it's one of my retro scans on vintagecomputing.com. But
what was the total amount?
Gosh, I don't remember. I could Google it real quick if you want.
Okay, that's fine. Let's just say it was a few hundred bucks, and we're talking 40 years ago.
All I did is I Googled Atari receipt, and mine is the first result. Okay, Atari 810 disk drive was $449. Star Raiders for $32. He ordered a joysticks for $15, but they're back ordered, so I will. Anyway, that was July 24th, 1981. That was when I was, 3 months old.
A polywog.
Yeah. So my first gaming experiences came on the Atari 800. We always had it set up somewhere where we could play it when I was little in the first house we lived in. It was either in my brother's room on a desk, which I've posted lots of pictures of that online in various places, or in our dining room on a special table in the corner. And it was always available, and my brother programmed a lot of games on it, and there was a lot of wizardry going on there that I was really impressed with. Because my brother's 5 years older than
me. Like literally the game wizardry? I didn't know that made it to Apple.
No, just figurative wizardry programming that really amazed me. And the first video games I ever remember playing were on that platform. So I think Atari basketball, and Donkey Kong. I remember my brother, running around me in basketball and frustrating me and kept dunking on me over and over again. But I was like, very little. So it is a deep part of my life. And whenever there's these games like Earthbound and some other games, like now in Stardew Valley, they ask you to list your favorite thing. And I always put Atari 800 in there. That's just, it's such a cultural, a big cultural force in my life. And I love the games. I still keep an Atari out all the time and play it with the kids, and I've built joysticks for it, and I could talk hours about my history with it. But
well, we might ask you to, depending on how long this podcast runs.
Yeah.
But yes, anyway, suffice to say that for you, the Atari 8-bit family is I guess sits in the same place for you that like the NES or something does for me.
Yeah, the funny thing about it though is that I never stopped using the Atari 800. We never stopped. Never. I mean,
still file your stories on it, right?
Yeah. Wait, what does that mean?
I mean, you, when you submit stories to How to Geek, you submit them like from an Atari 400. You type it on a 400 with a membrane keyboard and then send it up by 2600 baud modem.
Yeah, I just misunderstood what you said. I thought you said follow your stories like it was Twitter or something. Yeah, I file stories on.
There's probably someone who has created a Twitter application for Atari 800.
Yeah, probably. I think I've asked for that with this new Atari modem thing that we got, the FujiNet cartridge. But that's the funny thing about it is that since it came out, we always had it out, and if it wasn't out, it was nearby, and we'd get out once or twice a year and play it, and I literally never stopped all through my teenage years, all through my early adult years, all through the present. So it has never really gone obsolete. The games are that good, like Mule and Seven Cities of Gold, and some things like Archon just were never bested on any other platform, in my opinion. So it's always been there. Even the NES was a huge force in my life too, but there were times when we just stopped playing it for a few years, you know, because it was kind of old and whatever. But anyway, I think that's remarkable about this platform. That's why it's so special to me.
Yeah, I don't actually have anything equivalent to that in my life because I guess, you know, when I was a polywog, there weren't really home computers. And that actually gets back to kind of the origins of the 400 and the 800, which debuted in 1979. But of course, you know, they were in development for several years before that. And in the late 70s, home computers were starting to become a thing. Like, they didn't really exist as anything beyond theories or, like, you know, homes of the future drawings where people were, like, wearing, you know, polyester leisure suits while sitting in a hover chair looking out over a vista of a gleaming futuristic city and typing, like, recipes or whatever into their terminal on their armchair. Like, you know, up until the mid-70s, that's just what home computers were, just kind of this fanciful, imagined thing. But then, you know, in 1977-ish, the Apple II launched. Tandy launched its home computer line. What else was there? I feel like there was another.
The Commodore PET.
Yes, the Commodore PET. Okay, so all of those kind of debuted in the late 70s and made the idea of, you know, this thing that used to be like a room-sized machine that was used for calculating rocket trajectories. Like, now it could be in your home and you could do stuff on it and play, including playing video games, but also like typing stories or kind of whatever you did on computers before there was an internet or before there was a publicly accessible internet. And so Atari, you know, around the same time had made its debut in the console space with the Atari 2600 or VCS. And, you know, I don't think it took genius level intellect for them to say, well, you know, we've got a presence here and we're doing very well. Why don't we also, you know, have a presence over there and see how well we do there? And I think at the time, you know, the VCS was not designed for a long life. It was designed to be very, very cheap and, you know, like a consumer friendly device that could basically play Breakout or Pong. And, you know, when people started to do other things with it and go beyond its creator's ambitions, it kind of caught everyone by surprise. But at the time that the Atari computer lineup was initiated, the development of it, Atari just assumed, you know, this 2600 is not going to be with us a long time, and we need something that's going to come in and replace it. And the Atari 400 and 800 were kind of part of that. I don't know, Benj, if you can shed more light into kind of the overall strategy, because I know they had a bunch of different like platform concepts in mind at different budget levels, and those didn't all shake out.
Yeah, see, I talked to Joe DeCure, who is one of the designers of the 2600, you know, the game console and the Atari computer line, and he told me that the 2600 was just like Jeremy said, as a basic bare bones thing. They designed it with basically 1975 technology in mind, 76 technology in mind, even though it came out in 77. And the progress of semiconductor chips, integrated circuits, they just got dramatically more complex at an exponential rate. So even within like a year of designing that, is already basically obsolete, and they could create much more sophisticated things. So even while they were designing the 2600, they were thinking about its follow-up to be a computer, like a full computer, or a more sophisticated game machine at the same time. And they were trying to decide, should it be backward compatible with the VCS, which is the 2600's other name, or should it be a new platform, or, you know, what should they do? And so originally they had three plans. They wanted to do one that was an enhanced game machine that had an optional keyboard. And then they wanted to do one with an integrated keyboard. And then they wanted to do possibly a third one that had an integrated monitor and keyboard. And I think those were the three options at first. And eventually, as things shook down, they just went down to the game machine and the full computer. And then what happened is that after the Pokey chip was developed, which is one of the chips, it had I think it did the sound and some of the input-output stuff. And the audio. The guy who did that, Doug Neubauer, started programming a game called Star Raiders on this developing platform, even before it was complete. And it was based on the Star Trek mainframe games that where you warp to different sectors and you fight Klingons and stuff, but it was a real-time 3D first-person space battle simulator, and it was so amazing. It blew everybody at Atari away. The thing is it was so complicated, you couldn't just play it with a one-button joystick like on the VCS. You had to use the keyboard to push different commands like warp to sectors, use your shields, things like that. So they said, hey, we can't release this console with no keyboard because they won't be able to play Star Raiders on it. And so that's how the 400 was born, because they had to integrate a keyboard just for Star Raiders. And the funny thing is that changed Atari's history completely, that one branch. And in my opinion, that's one of the weirdest, most pivotal decisions that probably sealed Atari's fate in crashing. Instead of moving on to the next game machine quickly and iterating, they split the market into two segments where they milked the VCS for all it was worth for many, many years. And then they kept the home computer system separate, and they didn't emphasize its gaming potential for about 3 or 4 years. And it was weird because, you know, like Nolan, one of the reasons Nolan Bushnell left Atari is he wanted to, this is what he told me, is he wanted to, you know, the first Christmas the VCS was out, something like that, like 77 or something, it did horribly. And like the next year it didn't do very well. And he's like, this is, you know, not doing well. Let's go on and move on to the next thing. Something better now that's more sophisticated that we can do now with the better technology. And Warner thought he was nuts because they're like, we invested all this into building this thing and everything. And they argued about it. And that was just one of the reasons, not the only reason he left, but that was one of the big things that brought it to a head. And so he left Atari because, you know, he was disgusted with that and they were disgusted with him and so on and so forth. But that was one of the key things is he did have the foresight to see, look, we do need to keep iterating with the technology. We can't just milk this out because we won't be ready when the next generation comes with the competition. So I'll go back to the two machines. So the two machines became the 400 with the membrane keyboard. It's a flat keyboard that's really uncomfortable to type on.
It's not, yeah, like you don't want to type more than 2 or 3 words at a time on it. It's really bad.
Yeah, it's terrible. It looks really cool. The graphic design is awesome, like everything Atari. But
yeah, and it's, you know, it's super kit friendly because the membrane keyboard was, you know, watertight. You didn't have to worry about someone knocking a glass of orange juice into the system and like it leaking into the CPU through the keyboard, because it was just going to just, you know, like water on a robotic duck, just right off its back.
Yeah, Joe DeCure told me that it was specifically designed to be spill proof for kids and stuff. But that is also, it had an image problem because people didn't think of it as a fancy game console with a keyboard because of the way Atari marketed it. They marketed it as a computer. So it was like a really, you know, crappy computer, basically. So it got sort of hamstrung by that reputation of having the keyboard.
I mean, I don't think it's fair to call it a crappy computer. It definitely had less RAM than its counterpart, the 800, because it was called the 400 because it had 4K of RAM. Is that right?
Well, it shipped with 8K. Well, by the time they shipped, it shipped with 8K RAM. And they later increased it to 16K and stuff like that. But
yeah, like so it was a little underpowered in terms of its memory capacity compared to the competition. And it had that bad keyboard. But like internally, you know, the things it could do were really impressive.
Yeah. Are you talking about like the chips and stuff?
Yeah, like inside, it was not a crappy computer. Like it had, you know, it had a 6502B processor running at 1.79 megahertz. And there was another system, not a computer, but a system that came along later that had a 6502 variant running at 1.79 megahertz, which was Nintendo's NES and Famicom, which, you know, that did pretty well for itself. So that was impressive. It had the Pokey audio chip, which powered the sound hardware. It was like the sound hardware for Atari's arcade machines. Games like Missile Command and Tempest, like those distinctive, memorable sounds were from the Pokey chip. It had a graphical chip that took like the concepts of the 2600's TIA video chip and basically boosted it, you know, made it much more powerful and sophisticated. It had, it could display 256 colors. It had 382 pixel maximum vertical resolution, which wasn't as good as some computers, but, you know, still, you know, you could get a pretty good text display on there and great for graphics. And it wasn't just like text rendering. It had object rendering capabilities, which a lot of computers at the time didn't have. Like, it actually move sprites and things like that around. So, you know, there was a lot going on for the system in 1979. Like, it had a lot going for it.
It was an incredibly sophisticated game-playing machine. It had this incredible four-voice audio. It had, you know, sprite capabilities. It's basically graphical. It's like a GPU for the home computer at the time when every other computer was using software techniques to plot things on the screen. This had assistance in terms of the GTIA chip and all that. So, yeah, it was amazing. But that's, like, if you read my Fast Company article, it had a bit of an identity crisis because it's this really awesome game machine, but Atari was trying to market it as a really great productivity machine, but they also had this Atari image as a game company. And so it was sort of neither here nor there for a while, and until the prices dropped dramatically later.
Yeah, and you know, that it's not like that was some unique conundrum to Atari. Apple had the same problem for a long time. When the Mac launched, the Mac was amazing for video games. It had high-resolution graphics. It had a mouse-driven interface as well as a keyboard. Like, it could have done so much. But Steve Jobs was like, no, this can't be a video game machine. People will think it's a toy. It has to be presented as a, you know, a heavy-duty workstation. And so they kind of downplayed the game's potential of Macintosh for a long time. And it wasn't until, like, what, 1998 or so, when Steve Jobs came back to the company and decided to kind of reinvent the Mac, that he was like, yeah, look, we got John Carmack out here. You can play Quake 3 first on our grape machine. that was, you know, almost 15 years of the Mac, like, being this potentially great games machine, and Apple being like, oh, games, we don't know about that. Just trying to, I guess, avoid diluting its, you know, its appeal to the business market and the education market, but, like, you know, at the same time, estranging itself from the homes market, the home computer market.
Though it made for a great shareware library because there was nothing else on it, but that's a different podcast.
Yeah. Speaking of Steve Jobs, if you want to learn about Steve Jobs' computer, like, I've asked many people about why he didn't like video games and stuff. I did an interview with Trip Hawkins once that I think is republished on vintagecomputing.com, where he talks about Steve Jobs' game, you know, propensity to like games or not like them and stuff like that, because he worked for Apple for a little while. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's an aside. But
Trip Hawkins and Steve Jobs were both very early employees at Apple or Atari.
Oh, yeah. So let's see. Where were we? I think the thread.
You're talking about why the 400 was a crappy computer and how there was identity crisis.
And I meant by crappy computer, I meant like not a very practical productivity machine, mm-hmm. you know. And
that I can agree on.
It was mostly meant to be used with their cassette interface. I don't even know. I guess it's possible to use the disk drive, but there wasn't a lot of RAM, so you couldn't load a lot of the games on disk. But it was a really great game machine, and it could run games off cartridge. And the 800 had the full-stroke keyboard, and it had, you know, you could expand it up to 48K of RAM. I think the stock one may have shipped with 8 or 16K at first, and then you upgrade it over time by taking this panel off the back, and you slide these modules in. And that was one of the coolest things about the Atari 800, is because it was the first really consumer-friendly personal computer in terms of being idiot-proof. It didn't expose any electronics to the user, unlike the other things. Like an Apple II, you open up the back, you see all these circuits, capacitors, and things you could break off and mess with, you know, if you didn't know what you're doing. But Atari wanted to make it idiot-proof, where you could not plug the wrong thing into the wrong slot or the wrong connector.
So, and reading about this, I got the impression that this was also kind of forced on them by the FCC. who were like, well, if you have an open box, then there might be radio interference. And they were really, really strict about that, because I think they were still kind of in the mindset of like dealing with, you know, like ham radio operators and, you know, people who were broadcasting, as opposed to these kind of home-based devices where they were sending out like a very small amount of radiation. But yeah, it took a long time for, I think your article said TI was the company that ultimately pushed back and got those things changed, but it meant that the 400 and 800 couldn't be open systems. So they were kind of limited by design. But I do think, you know, as you said, that kind of worked in a certain level to the system's favor, you know, to its benefit, because it was idiot-proof. You know, if you wanted to upgrade, you could buy like a simple plug-and-play module, which was, I think, pretty innovative back then.
Yeah, but think of it this way. The FCC, the novelty of plugging a device into your TV set to and simulating a broadcast signal. And I mean, this was new. They're designing this in 1977, and the video game console had just come out 5 years before that. In 1972, the first game console. That's like, what is this, 2021? That's like in 2016. You know, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. So the FCC hadn't caught up with this innovation yet, and they had really draconian rules about devices that could emanate and interfere with broadcast reception, TV reception. And so since it was designed to hook directly to a TV set with an RF modulator that created radio frequency to, you know, simulate the antenna input on a TV set, Atari had to build in all kinds of huge, thick shielding to shield the electronics that naturally emanate radio frequency just by running, like every electronic circuit does. And that did stop them from doing the open slots, which Dojo Kira said he really wanted to do to make an Apple II-like system. But the funny thing is that because of that, they invented this SIO, the serial interface, the serial IO bus that was sort of like a precursor to USB for the Atari 800, in the sense that each device was an intelligent peripheral with its own microprocessor and its own address on a bus. And they could all, and you just plug it in. You don't have to install drivers. The drivers are sort of built into the device, and it's incredible how it works. There's people still making devices that just plug in and can be installed as a as just a new device with a drive with a special letter on the like a that each device has its own letter, like J, K, L, that kind of thing. And so it's very extensible, it's very flexible, it was a beautiful, elegant design. And unfortunately, it was very expensive to make things that way, because the peripherals became more expensive. If you have to install, if you have to put shielding in each peripheral, if you have to put the interface board, you have to put a microprocessor in it and all that stuff, compared to like a bare bones where Woz is building this, the Apple II card with as few circuit chips as possible, with this basic stripped down floppy drive with barely any electronics in it, you know, to make it dirt cheap and fast and awesome, compared to Atari has to build a whole computer into each floppy drive, basically. I mean, there's a 6502 in each floppy drive, I'm pretty sure. Last time I took one apart. So that was a commercial hamper on the system. It also played into, it really was a disadvantage later during the price wars when Commodore started driving the prices down. Atari couldn't quickly pivot to make a cheaper machine because they're very expensive to manufacture, the 400, 800 as they were. And they tried redesigning them, but they were, then they charged too much money for the redesigns and all that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big factor. Like, people, you know, I think talk about how Pac-Man and E.T. for Atari 2600 destroyed the company, but the computer line had so much more, I think, to do with the company's kind of fizzling out in the great video games crash of 1982-83, because they had so much invested in this platform And as you said, they couldn't race to the bottom. And the Commodore 64 was definitely pushing the envelope and racing to the bottom. And they basically wiped out the competition. TI couldn't keep up and bankrupted themselves basically doing that. Atari, you know, devastated Warner's bottom line trying to keep up. And eventually Atari was like, you know, actually, we've made things too cheap, and we are actually going to raise prices on this platform soon, and kind of walked it back a little bit. But yeah, the Commodore race to the bottom was really a huge part of what destroyed the console and computer market at the time, and crashed the American games industry. So you know, it's not fair to blame poor Howard Scott Warshaw for all of Atari's ails.
Yeah, that's something I discovered while I was researching this article we're talking about, is that, you know, I did start digging into the actual press of the time, reading all these articles about home computer crisis, home computer this and that, and the drive to the bottom. And Chris Crawford, who was a, you know, famous game designer, and he worked for Atari, he told me, when I interviewed him for this article, he told me that Atari's computer division was never profitable. And I changed it to largely unprofitable because I couldn't, like, you know, in the article, because I couldn't back that up with anything other than what he was remembering. But it was basically never profitable. And so they were funding that completely on the boom of the 2600, which was huge in 1981, 1982. And then things started 80, 81, and some of 82. And then as the market got oversaturated because of Activision and all that stuff, making the third parties floodgates open with poor quality content. And then also, like Jeremy said, Commodore came in with the VIC-20 first in 1981, a very low price machine. And then with the Commodore 64, Jack Tramiel said, let's do an all-out war. And it was like a scorched earth war, dropping prices. And yeah, Atari and TI couldn't keep up. And then by the middle of 1983, computers that were selling for $500 were like $50, you know. So what I read in all those articles were, everybody said, why buy a game console when you can get an awesome computer for $50, you know? So that I think Jack Tramiel is more responsible for the crash than anybody else, other than just like, I think it's probably 50-50. Okay, I'll say the glut of games for the 2600, but also this thing, you know, crashing the industry. So anyway, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Atari was kind of working with the computer, the razor and blade model, where computers were going to be very inexpensive and, you know, a loss leader basically, and then they would make it up with peripherals and software and so forth. And originally Atari didn't open up the platform to outside publishers. It was basically all first party publishing. And it wasn't until, I don't know, what did prompt them to say, hey, you know what, maybe we should have other people make games for the system, you know, and software. Because if you look at a list, there's a list at atarimania.com of basically all official 800 and 400 software. And if you look at it, 1979, 1980, 1981, there's like nothing on the system. It's, you know, maybe like a dozen releases per year, if that. But then you look at 1982 when they open up the system, and all of a sudden it's like an explosion, you know. And it's kind of bad timing, because that's right when, you know, the Atari 2600 market started to explode because of the integration of, or the involvement of third parties that were kind of, the door was opened to them by the courts after Activision stepped away and Atari tried to sue them. But yeah, 82, 83, it's just, there's so many games and software applications
I can
you
answer
could buy
that
for 400 and 800.
Yeah, I can answer that, which is, you know, the time when they, historically, the time when Atari treated the 800 platform as a closed platform was pretty brief. I mean, it came out in late 79, and then Chris Crawford was telling me sometime in 1980 they changed their minds, and so it was like probably 6 months really. But that 6 months did do a lot of damage, because all the press was so slow. all the pre-release press probably says this is a closed platform with Atari only stuff, you know, and everybody got that message, and it takes a long time to update that message, you know, in the press in 1980. It wasn't like the internet where you tweet out a new thing every 10 minutes or 5 seconds. So it did do a lot of damage. There were people when this was previewed in early 79 were asking Chris Crawford, hey, can I write things for this? And he had to say, sorry, but no, you know. And so that message was out there for throughout most of 79, even before the computer came out. And so what I think happened is the Activision exodus did a ton of damage to Atari. Mm-hmm. No one ever talks about this. This is me reading between the lines. But all of their star developers, they're most of them, not everybody. There's a bunch of people there. But their top talent left. Their top talent also was responsible for developing the operating system for the Atari 800 and some of its applications, like David Crane and Al Miller. They did a lot of important things for the 400 and 800 and the OS and things like that. And so suddenly, if all the people who developed all your Atari computer software leave, like, where are you going to get that software? We have no choice but to open it up to third parties, right? And so they also were looking at Apple's success. Apple was a huge press and market success after VisiCalc, and they were so open about third parties. It became like people, these third parties were making a gold mine on the Apple II platform, and it was bringing such a lot of strength to the Apple II platform because everyone said, hey, this platform has all these applications you can buy and use. It's a very useful machine. It's worth the money. Mm-hmm. And but people looked at Atari and said, they barely have any applications, so why would I buy an Atari? And so Chris Crawford, once they got it open, the Atari 800 was open, he created a group called the Software Development Support Group within Atari. And he wrote a development Bible called De Re Atari, which means all about Atari in Latin. And it became the guide for Atari computer programming. It unlocked all the secrets of how to program those special chips and do all that special stuff. And I can't remember if Dayray was in 81 or so, but look, you've already lost a year and a half or so on sitting around with that. And then Dale Yoakum, who was another Atari employee, invented this cool thing called the Atari Program Exchange too, which had a plan to solicit programs from the general public and then publish them in bare bones packaging and give the creators a royalty. So it was basically like an app store, but mail order at the time. And once those two opened up, it took a year or two after that, but the floodgates really started to open with a lot of third-party developers, indie developers making great games. But they lost some time there, you know.
Hello everyone, we're Superhero Stuff You Should Know, and if you think you know about superheroes and comic books, think again.
We got romance, we got action,
romance.
We got comedy, we got everything you need, man. Come on down to Superhero Stuff You Should Know for all your superhero needs.
I don't know about this romance, what part are you talking about?
We've got all kinds of sketches, and then deep dives on top of that. Come on down to Superhero Stuff You Should Know.
Alright, so come on down to... Wait, why did I say come on down? To Superhero Stuff You Should Know.
Part of the Greenlit Podcast Network.
When it hasn't been your day, your week, your month, or even your year, we'll be there for you. I'm Ryan, the line is always a duck to me.
And I'm Mark, how you doing?
We're a podcast of two friends watching Friends, reliving every episode of the TV show in all its glory, delving behind the scenes and discussing all our favourite moments.
Join us as we get reacquainted with some old friends and hopefully make some new ones along the way, only on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
So So now that we've kind of made a case for the good and the bad of the platform and the logistical challenges, Benj, I was hoping you could kind of walk us through all the different variants that Atari attempted to create throughout the years. I mean, people think of the 400 and the 800 because those were the kind of primary platforms. Between the two of them, they sold several million units. Really great market penetration for the time. Obviously not on par with the 2600, but, you know, considering it cost 10 times as much or five times as much, you know, it's, you know, respectable. So they created a bunch of variant models, which some of them never came to fruition. Some of them came to fruition and the market said, wow, these are really bad. Then some of them, I think, did okay for themselves. And that kind of kept them going until they replaced their 8-bit computer line with the ST line, which is probably worth its own episode because it was a really capable system that saw a lot of kind of definitive games. And I know especially people in Europe have a lot of fondness for the ST. And it competed kind of on the same level as the Mac and the Amiga. So good stuff. But, you know, that was 1985, and the system, the 8-bit stuff, was around for quite a while and kind of, you know, had to keep the company going during its big changeover from Atari Inc. to Atari Corp. and Atari Games, the big split. Jack Tramiel coming in and saying, hey, I cratered Atari, now I'm going to buy it up.
That was bitter. It made some Atari fans really bitter at the time.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Like, when you really stop and think about it, it's like someone basically wearing the hollowed out corpse of the man they killed. Terrible. Just brutal.
So let's see. The first, after the 400, 800, the next one was the 1200 XL, which was released in, I think, early 1983. And it had 64K of RAM. It was a simplified design in terms of less shielding, less beef to it. The funny thing, the 400 and 800 have these huge cast aluminum inner shield / heat sink things that are huge and heavy. And the 1200 probably has some thin aluminum shielding in it, and it was cheaper and lighter and more integrated. You know, they needed fewer chips by that point because of the technology had improved, especially with RAM and things like that. So they could ship with 64K of RAM, but unfortunately, they launched it with an $899 price, and it was like, I think it was more expensive than the Atari 800 at the time.
Yeah, I think they bumped the 800 price down because they were trying to, you know, compete.
Yeah, so everybody started, from what I read, reports at the time, a lot of people went and raced and bought 800s, like, because it was a little more flexible in terms of the biggest drawback of the 1200 was that it did have some incompatibilities with some 400 and 800 software, but it had a pretty nice keyboard. It's this flat sort of wedge shape with a new design language with cream and dark brown and slanted vents on the back of it, and it's a neat unit, but it was a dud because of its price, basically. And so after pressure from, you know, Commodore with the 64 and all that stuff, which had already come out then, but the price wars had continued to drive things down. And so in the summer of 83, Atari released another iteration, which is what they should have done to begin with, the 600 XL and the 800 XL. And the 600 XL is sort of like a replacement for the 400, but it had a full-stroke keyboard, and it had 16K of RAM built into it. And the 800 XL was like a replacement for the 800, and so it had 64K of RAM, and it had most of these had BASIC built into them, and you didn't need a cartridge anymore, which was nice.
So Jeremy wouldn't have been left just typing on the memo pad.
God dang it.
These machines are really good, really well-designed. They are... I still use it. I prefer an 800 XL. I use it all the time just because it's small, it's compact, it doesn't make a lot of heat, it's reliable, has an accessible cartridge slot on the top. You just plug it in and it works great. The video quality is good, output and all that stuff, and it has the RAM you need. And I think the 800 XL is a great choice for anyone who wants to buy one of these systems now and get started with it, because most of them still work without any modifications.
Which is pretty impressive 30 years later.
Oh, yeah, definitely. compared to like Macs from the 90s that all need new capacitors and stuff, this is a really good, reliable design.
So where in your opinion does the XE line fall in here? Like, do you think it's good, bad, stupid?
XE is kind of cool. The thing about that is those are the first from the Tramiel era, Atari Corp era Atari. So in 1985, they announced the Atari ST and these XE machines. So there's the 65XE and the 130XE. And the 65XE is basically a replacement for the Atari 800XL. So it has 64K of RAM. But these two machines have the design language of the Atari ST line, so they match it visually. And they have a slightly different keyboard and a slanted look to the buttons on the top, the start buttons and things. And they're pretty neat. The 130XE is really popular because it's the only machine with 128 kilobytes of RAM. And it's got good compatibility, good video output, and stuff like that. So a lot of people who want the maximum Atari experience without upgrading the RAM or anything will get a 130XE. I think they're kind of expensive now on the used market, but they were more popular in Europe. So if you play a lot of European games, they will require 128K of RAM, and you'll need a 130XE or something like that. But they were, you know, moderately popular, not incredibly well selling, but not failures either. They sold really well in Europe, especially the XE line. And those were, supported up until 1992 when they pulled the plug on the whole thing. But then there's one more thing.
Yes. I love this one. It's my favorite.
The XE game system.
The XEGS. It's my favorite. I think it might be my favorite 80s console design outside of the Sega Mark III, which, like, you can't touch that. But the XEGS is, like, the opposite of the Mark III, where the Mark III is, like, super sleek and sophisticated, all, like, angles and sharp lines and just so streamlined. The XEGS is... It's also, you know, streamlined, but it has a lot of... it has a lot of goofiness to it. It's got four pastel-colored huge buttons on the front of the console. It just, like, no one else made a game console that looks like this, and it's so weird and yet so, like, divinely 80s. It's a gorgeous piece of hardware. I love it.
Yeah,
I looked up a picture of it. It is pretty amazing looking.
Oh yeah, 1987, Atari releases, in response to Nintendo basically and the success of the NES and the Sega Master System, things like that. They repackage all this Atari 8-bit computer technology into the XE game system. It's basically a 65XE with a different ROM in it. It has a missile command built in. It has BASIC built in that boots up if you plug in this keyboard. And so the way it was sold is in several packages. There was one that just had the BASIC console with no keyboard and a joystick. And that was like basically supposed to be a game machine by itself. But you could get one with a keyboard, this modular keyboard with a cable that plugs in. And when you plug that in, you get BASIC. And you can also use the Atari disk drives, the same peripherals from the XE line and all that stuff. So it is a hybrid computer game console. And I think it's really neat. I'm using one right now as my desktop weather terminal. I don't know if I wrote an article about that for How To Geek last year, but with the FujiNet modem, this device that people have made that lets you hook it to the internet, and someone made this weather application that always will update the weather from the internet and put it on a screen. I put a little CRT on my desk, and I have the XEGS driving that all the time. I just leave it on 24 hours a day. It sips power with this new power supply I got, and it's cool. I just turn on the monitor. I want to see, like, right now it's 60 degrees outside, clear sky. I get the weather forecast right here.
Nice. So your XEGS is now your Internet of Things device. That's pretty amazing.
It's reliable and beautiful. I do love the pastel buttons, too. Some of my friends in the Atari community don't like them, but I like them.
They're pretty great.
They don't know anything. But the thing is, the XEGS, which was such a boneheaded concept, because Atari had just launched the year before a console to compete with Nintendo and Sega Master System, the Atari 7800, which of course was held over from 1984, but it was a very capable system. It was, you know, really kind of the next step evolution beyond the 5200 and the 2600. And, you know, the 5200 is basically compatible almost with the 8-bit computer line, which we'll talk about momentarily. But the 7800, you know, took it to the next level. It had some really fantastic arcade ports. I've been covering it a lot on NES Works Gaiden on my my YouTube channel. And, you know, I realize now I need to, you know, for to be proper, I need to stick XEGS coverage in there too, which... anyway,
good
luck. The thing is, so you had the XEGS, you had the 7800. At the same time, Atari was still supporting, to some degree, the 2600, which saw games released for it until like 1991.
Wow.
And the 5200 was still getting some kind of flagging support.
What were they thinking?
You also had the Atari ST, and then you had, you know, various other computer lines, the XC65, 130, etc. All of these were Atari products on the market. There wasn't that much cross-compatibility between them. Like, you could play 2600 games on 7800, okay, and you could play XE games on XEGS, and I think there was some cross-compatibility between 5200 and XEGS. Am I right?
No.
No. Oh, God. Why? And, of course, the ST couldn't do anything with any of that.
No, yeah.
And then, you know, in 1989, you got the Lynx. So
I feel Atari from 1983 on, everything they did was reactive. It was a reactive product to some kind of perceived market need. And I think that's why they did such a scattershot approach that didn't have any overall strategy. The redesigns to begin with, the 1200, 800 XL, 600 XL, those were all reactions to the price wars and Commodore and all that stuff. And the XE line was, I don't know, just to make a new design language. The ST was a reaction to the Macintosh. The 7800 was, you know, held over, but they only released it later because it's a reaction to Nintendo and things like that. And the XE game system, God knows what that's a reaction to. It's part of this, the Nintendo thing. Maybe it's a second stab at it. Like, the 7800, not doing that well in market. Let's take this technology again and put it in a game console again after the 5200, which we haven't talked about.
Yeah, I mean, the 7800, like, it didn't do well initially because it was just, like, old new stock, basically, that they pumped out into the marketplace. And they didn't even release all the launch games for it for like 2 years. Like, it was 2 years later that Desert Falcon, which was a, you know, an original creation for the system that was designed for 1984, came to the market. Like,
yeah, if they had released the 7800 in 84, it would have been a much smarter move.
I mean, the market at that point was, retailers would have said, no thanks, a game system, yeah, go to hell.
Yeah, sorry, in an alternate universe, had things been better, that would have been a good,
if not for Jack Tramiel.
Yeah, 84 was super dead. In fact, there's a funny thread on Twitter. I was talking to, like, we were trying to discover games released in 1984.
Console games?
Yeah.
Because there were lots of PC games. But yeah, like, if you look at Computer Entertainer magazine and the video game update newsletter that was contemporary, like the contemporaneous publication, there were entire months where no new console games were published for any system, even though there were all these platforms on the market that you could still buy at retail. Like, people were just not making new games. It was all just, you know, clearing out stock.
We should probably jump back and talk about the 5200.
Yeah.
Yes, that is next on the agenda, because it is basically the Atari 400 as a console with a cut-down ROM. Like, it doesn't have as much operating system ROM because it doesn't run programs. It's just games. And yet, despite the common technology and the fact that you can pretty easily tweak, you know, hack programs from one platform to run on another, kind of like you can do with Sega SG-1000, ColecoVision, MSX, they didn't talk to each other. They didn't work with each other. You can't play a 5200 game on an 800, and likewise.
I think that was probably smart at the time, because they would have had to put a keyboard on the 5200 then, you know, because most of the games relied on
it. But, you know, Sega's solution for that with the SG-1000, they also released the SC-3000 at the same time, which was an SG-1000 with, you know, like basically a keyboard. They included a ribbon cable connector on the SG-1000, and you could just buy a keyboard externally and stick it on that ribbon cable, and all of a sudden your console was a computer. And they even they even talked about doing that with the original design for the 8-bit computers, of having a console that had an optional add-on keyboard. I don't know why they didn't do that. Like, they, I feel like that would have made the 5200 so much more compelling.
And the 5200 had ended up with this weird compromise where you just had a controller that had a whole bunch of buttons on it, and had a little mini keypad, but not a full keyboard.
You're right. There's the start. There's like basically the start option sort of buttons on the controller instead of on the console. So this is the way I see the 5200. Okay, so they're doing really well with the Atari 800. I mean, sorry, the Atari 2600 in 80, 81. And then 82, they're starting to say, uh-oh, we know things are starting to slip. We haven't announced it yet. We better rush this damn thing to market the sequel, the successor. Let's take our technology, the architecture from the 8-bit computer line. Now it's cheap enough to put in a console by this time. Let's redesign it, put it into a console. Let's add some really horrible analog joysticks. Still, I have no idea whose idea that was because I never investigated that.
I mean, the idea of analog joysticks is a good impulse. An analog joystick that does not recenter on its own is a very bad implementation of a good idea. That was the problem. It wasn't like, oh, they created analog joysticks. How stupid. It was, oh, they created an analog joystick where, like, the controller doesn't know that you've stopped pressing in a direction, so it just keeps going in that direction.
And there's,
Pac-Man,
like, a lot of games.
Pac-Man, great times with that one.
Yeah, so, and the freaking Pac-Man was the pack-in game was Pac-Man with this horrible controller that doesn't do four directions very well. It does every single direction.
It was so much more impressive than the 2600 version of Pac-Man. Yeah. But in terms of playability, like, I have played 5200 Pac-Man, and it looks great, and then you play it and it doesn't play well at all because the controller just feels mushy and off, and Pac-Man's always doing stuff you don't want him to do. It's the opposite of how it should have been.
Yeah, there's so many reviews of 5200 games that's like, this is a great game if only it weren't for this crappy controller that I'm playing it on.
Yeah.
And like, and it's especially sad because there's a lot of games on it that actually, you know, take advantage of the analog controller in interesting ways. It's just this particular analog controller is bad, which makes it not so fun to play because you're wrestling with the fact that it doesn't recenter.
Yeah, there's, I'd say, a couple of problems with the analog thing. One is that I think it was Kurt Vendel, may he rest in peace, told me that they had wanted to make a centering controller, but they wanted to save money and took a spring out or something that would have centered, you know, did self-centering, you know, to save a couple cents per controller. And that was a really dumb decision, if that's true. Also, the games were not designed with an analog controller in mind. They were ports of the Atari 800 games, almost all of them, except for a few.
Yeah.
Like, there was a good version of Centipede, things like that. And so there were only, I think, like, there's one called Space Dungeon or something. I think that takes advantage of the analog controller, but I don't remember any
others. I looked
up
that one. I want to talk about that. It looks really cool.
Yeah, so you've got all these games that do not need an analog controller, and you give them this mushy, imprecise analog controller that doesn't recenter, and it's just the worst of all possible worlds. And that, in addition to, I don't know, the 5200 console, the first one was the four-port one was gigantic. It's like, I still want someone to put it by a PS5 and see which is bigger. But it's like, until recently, it was the biggest console ever released. It had slots in the back to store the consoles in.
The controller.
It's just a huge honking piece of plastic.
Yeah, it definitely falls into that period of time where home console makers were trying to figure out how to make a better controller than the 2600 and the Apple II sticks, which were, you know, very simple one button kind of things. And everyone arrived at the same solution of make it a telephone and put some sort of weird, horrible control stick at the top. So, you know, you had Intellivision's disc, you had the ColecoVision mushroom, and you had the non-centering analog joystick of the 5200. All of them good ideas in theory, bad ideas in execution. So bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Super Breakout. I think the first launch title was Super Breakout, like you put in the notes. And that could use the analog thing because it's a paddle game. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty neat. But they started putting Pac-Man in it pretty soon after as a pack-in, and that was just a terrible, terrible decision.
There were several games that were like basically twin-stick shooters or variations on that concept, which took advantage of multiple directional sticks. But again, the actual stick's so clunky, like makes it tough to pull off.
Yeah. One of the essential accessories is one of these converter boxes like I have that lets you use an Atari 2600 joystick on the 5200. Hmm. But at that point, you're playing all the same games as you'd play on the 800 computer, basically. So you're like, might as well just play them on the 800, mm-hmm. which is why I never touch my 5200. And I look at it in shame. I just don't like that.
the shame is not yours, though, so yeah. Don't feel bad. No, we've been just bagging on the 5200, but there were some things that were appealing about it. I mean, it was a home console that basically had a home computer inside of it in 1982. That's very impressive. Like, you know, compared to the Intellivision or even the ColecoVision, it really, like, it was a very capable machine, even with the smaller ROM. It had, you know, much more capable graphics than the 2600, but it still, you know, because it used that same sort of by scanline object-based drawing system as the 2600, but advanced, it still had the Atari look, which is something I can't put my finger on exactly, but it's even there on the 7800. There's just a look about these systems, and you're like, that is an Atari console. Hell yes.
Yeah.
The you know, it had great arcade conversions, the interface, you know, the control stick issue aside, you know, by far some of the best conversions of arcade games to be found in the era. Like, you know, ColecoVision had some really great conversions too, but Coleco could only really get the second stringers aside from Donkey Kong. So they were like, you know, kind of the B-tier games, whereas the 5200 was on par with the ColecoVision in terms of power and in terms of, you know, how it expressed that for arcade conversions. But, you know, they were dealing with A-tier games like Missile Command, Breakout, Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, you know, Frogger, that sort of thing. Stuff that the Coleco just couldn't get because Atari had locked up the rights.
Yes.
And also, it looked great. Yes, it was a very big system, but it was so sleek. You know, the 2600 is this kind of comfortable piece of 1970s wood grain home stereo equipment. You put it there, you know, on your deep shag orange rug, and it's just like, yeah, it belongs. But the 2600 says, no, baby, the 80s are here. We are in a new decade. It's time for some cocaine. You can just do lines right off this sleek, flat surface. Just snort it up, my friend. You and John DeLorean, and you're going to have a great time tonight. And, you know, it looks great. It's a great looking system. It's very powerful. It has some really cool tech innovations kind of running behind the scenes. You can run the system off, like power it from the RF switch on your TV. So you mm-hmm. don't have to have this bulky separate brick.
Yeah, I didn't even know that was
possible.
And it
had automatic switching from the TV when you turned it on. Like, that's mm-hmm. so cool. You didn't have to fuss around and like go to the back of your TV and switch that little RF converter from TV to game. Like, you know, they really put a lot of thought into many of the elements of the system. They just really missed the ball in some big, seemingly in retrospect, obvious ways. And it's frustrating because I think there is the potential for something really amazing here that just didn't happen.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway,
that's my impassioned rant.
Yeah.
It also was released at the absolute wrong time because of the market crash. It mm-hmm. killed it too. You know, it didn't have the chance to come into its own as a platform with really dedicated 5200 games that took advantage of the controller or any unique properties of the system. So that's what I think about it. It has this – we didn't mention – I don't know. The controller has a numeric keypad, and they did use that as a stand-in for extra input from Atari 800 games. And it has a pause button on the controller, which is neat. That was pretty mm-hmm. Innovative at the time.
I would say the nicest thing about the 5200 is that it ultimately received, in terms of official software support, 69 games.
Yes. Yeah, so it's a very sexual console.
So it's your John DeLorean cocaine orgy. That's the important part.
So yeah, well, like most of its games were ports either from arcade or from the 800. I did try to look up real quick, like what games were unique to the 5200. And yeah, there's very, very few.
Yes.
The only one I found that seems like it was actually developed originally for the 5200 is this weird game called Countermeasure. You're in this kind of clunky tank. That drives very slowly and even slowly over different kinds of terrain. And it's this, big vertical play field. And you're driving up around, there's like villages and forests and stuff. And you're countering these terrorists, who have like gun emplacements and stuff. And ultimately what you're trying to do is take out these missile silos, which are gonna rain nuclear death on Washington, D.C. That's the plot. And so you can drive through trying to take out these missile silos, but also as you go through, you get pieces of a disarm code that you can use to disarm the missiles. So you're on this strict time limit, and evidently it's extremely difficult to actually make it to all the missile silos and blow it up. So what you eventually do once you have enough pieces of the code is get out of your tank into one of the missile silos, and then you have a few seconds to put in the right code and disarm the missiles and win the game. So it's kind of a weird concept, but it's a pretty cool looking game. It's a very busy play field. I don't know. I watched some playthroughs. Obviously, I haven't actually played it. I'm not sure how much fun it actually is, but it's certainly doing some interesting things.
I've not played it, but it makes it, you make me want to play it.
Yeah, and it's using the sticks because you're driving the tank in every direction, and you can shoot in a different direction from where you're driving.
Are you using twin sticks, you're saying?
I think you are, yeah. That's awesome. I'm pretty sure.
The Space Dungeon will let you do that, too. I think it had a mount you could stick the two sticks in, and you do twin stick shooting.
Right. Use two controllers like a twin stick. Space Dungeon is another one I want to talk about because it was originally arcade, but I think the 5200 was its only port, unlike most of these other arcade ports that were also ported to like everything else in the day. Space Dungeon looks really cool. It's kind of so at first it looks kind of like Robotron because it's a twin stick thing. You're driving around and shooting in whatever direction. But it's also kind of a dungeon crawler. So you've got this ship, but you're in like this 6x6 grid of rooms. And you're going from room to room, shooting enemies and trying to pick up treasures and then get to the like exit room. And there's actually a little mini map in the corner that shows you what rooms you've been in and where the exit is. And it's even got like persistence, like a dungeon crawler. If you die, you drop all your treasure and then you come back and that room where you died is marked with an X in your map and all that treasure you had is still there. You can go pick it back up. Mm-hmm. And then you get out of this 6x6 grid and there's like 100 more levels of the same thing. So it's this huge dungeon crawler that's also a twin stick shooter, which is not something I've seen very much of and sounds pretty damn cool.
Yeah, this is really cool. I've never actually played it on the 5200 either. I've been meaning to.
The other impression it really gave me when I was watching this is it really reminds me of, I think it was called Crystal Quest, old Mac OS shareware.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It really had that feel to it, like the same of driving around shooting things twin stick wise and then going between rooms. I wouldn't be surprised if this was an inspiration for that.
Yeah. All right, so we've got like 10 minutes left. So I think we do need to talk about the most important or, you know, significant games on Atari 8-bit home computers really quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, Benji's already mentioned Star Raiders, which was, you know, early 3D space combat sim with 3D graphics and stuff. But, you know, you look at the other games that debuted on the system, you had Lucasfilm Games begin its legacy. They got a huge cash infusion from Atari and were told to make some cool games because they made cool computer graphics for movies. So those are the same thing, right? And they said, okay, we'll take the challenge. And they came up with Ball Blazer, an amazing, for the time, first-person perspective sports game, split-screen, very kind of confusing at first, but very technically impressive. And Rescue on Fractalis, a procedurally generated first person like space or not space shooter but
canyon,
you know,
shooter.
Like, yeah, canyon shooter basically, right?
Yeah,
so you're like flying around and it's all generated on the fly. So very impressive.
It kind of seems like a first-person defender because you're going around rescuing mm-hmm. troops off the ground while flying through this. But they've got, yeah, as the name implies, you've got this fractally generated landscape, which is really cool.
The Eidolon was like the same thing, but inverted. So they took the technology from Rescue and Fractalis and they turned it upside down. And instead of being flying through a cavern, you're going through caves. And it's like a first-person dungeon crawler, basically. And it's insanely technically impressive. And for some reason, I did not have those games back in the day. But if I had had them, I would have really loved them. They're so amazing.
I think they came out later. So, you know, by that mm-hmm. point, the market had kind of shifted. So that mm-hmm. might have been why you missed it. But you also had, this is where Spelunker came from, a game that kind of mm-hmm. took on a life of its own in Japan when it made it to Famicom. But, you know, it had a pretty good following here in the West. And then, you know, kind of came back and became notorious decades later when Derek Yu and Mossmouth adapted the concepts into a basically an action roguelike Spelunky.
Yep.
You had, was this the platform that Mule was originally created for, not Apple II?
Yep. Mule is the greatest.
Tell us about it, Binge.
Well, Danny Buntenberry created Mule, and it's a strategy game for four players that's about a battle for resources on a planet you colonize. You land on a planet in the beginning, and each colonist has their own character that looks like a robot, and then you battle over squares on a map, and each square has its own properties, like a mountainous square has its own sort of resource on it, and water-based square has another one, things like that. And you harvest them by using mules, multiple use labor elements, which are these donkey looking robots that you buy at a store in the middle of the map, and you place them on these grids, squares, to mine crystite and all those different things. And so it's the coolest thing about it is that four people can play at one time, and the 400 was notable for having, and the 800 for having, four joystick ports on the front. And even though Mule is a turn-based game, there's this one mode of the game where you do this real-time trading where all four people are moving their characters up and down to set a price to buy and sell goods in real time, and there's a time limit. And with the sound effects in the background and ticking down, it's really high stakes, kind of stressful and fun and exciting. And so there's a lot of depth to this game. It's timeless. It's just a timeless strategy. It's sort of like a board game with some action elements just in terms of the trading to it. And it's a classic. It's one of the greatest games of all time, in my opinion. I think I rated it as number like 2 or 3 or something in my greatest PC games of all time when I did that a long time ago. And another game done
well,
by...
Well, actually, I have a question before about Mule. Was the original version of that for Atari systems, was that modem capable, or did that come later?
No, it's never been modem capable. You're thinking of Modem Wars, which was a different game done by Danny Berry.
But it also starts with an M, so she that was just her thing, I guess, was like multiplayer competitive stuff. Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was a very innovative designer, obviously.
And this was under the Electronic Arts label, back when they were like, artists, Electronic Arts, we should celebrate our creators and do amazing things.
Yeah, Electronic Arts was really cool back in the day. They don't have a great reputation now, but when they first started, they published a string of really amazing games, like Mule, Archon,
One-on-One,
Seven Cities of Gold, One-on-One, the Pinball Construction Set, and various other things. And they treated, you know, it was Trip Hawkins' vision to treat the artists like musicians. And so each one would look like an album. Each game is in this flat pack, like a square, like a record sleeve. And they have the names of the designer prominently on the label. And
which was a big departure for back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big departure, and I think that started in, gosh, 84. I don't know. I did a big thing about Trip Hawkins once, and that's what I mentioned earlier.
Didn't Activision do that with like David Crane and that sort of thing?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They did that. So that was riffing off of Activision's thing, but taking it a little bit further with artsy label designs and things like that.
Got it.
So another thing they did, another Ozark Associates, which is Ozark Associates developed Mule. And they developed also the Seven Cities of Gold, which originated on the 800, which is another one of my favorite games of all time, where you are a Christopher Columbus-type explorer coming from Europe to the New World. And you explore, you interact with native tribes, you trade, you do things like that. But the coolest thing about it at the time was that you could generate a completely new continent every game if you wanted to. It would be procedurally generated. So you could play one version as like the real Americas as they are on the map, but or you could create a whole new one, and then you play through the whole game, making little forts and things like that and trading, and it's a strategy game with some action elements, and it's really deep and fun, and it was just so mind-blowingly deep for the time, just the depth of it. You didn't get any kind of depth like that on a 2600 or even in Nintendo games for a while, they weren't that deep. And so we loved that. I played that more than anything. And Archon is another Electronic Associates system by Freefall Associates. This is my brother's favorite game. He still loves Archon. So it's like a action chess game. So you see a board that looks like a chess board. And every piece, there's a dark side and a light side. And every piece is some sort of monster. There's like, manticores and basilisks and genies and wizards, things like that. And you try to control these power points on the grid, this chessboard thing. And it shifts over time from light to dark. So if it's darker on one side, the dark side is favored. If it's lighter at one time, the light side is favored. They're more powerful. And if you...
So like Dark Souls tendencies?
I don't know. I never played that.
Okay. But I just felt like we needed some sort of Dark Souls reference. Okay.
Yeah. The point is you battle each other in a real-time action combat. So instead of, capturing a piece, when the pieces interact, then you go to this new screen and the two creatures fight each other, each player with a joystick in an action. Sometimes some of them shoot things, some of them club each other, and it's really intense and fun. So it's action and strategy mixed into one, and it's really great. And
it's that holo chest that they had on the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, basically. Pretty much.
Yeah, I think it was inspired by that or something like that. So
probably. And there was also Battle Chess. I don't know if that came before or after Archon.
No, that was after.
Okay.
Battle Chess doesn't have action elements. It's just chess with animations.
Yeah, so. I know.
Yeah. But
it still made an impression. Like, I saw it as a kid on computers. It was like, man, that's so cool. They're just, beating the crap out of each other.
But it was cool. It was so cool. Yeah.
Closer to my heart, a game I haven't played on the original Atari platform since, seeing a store demo 100 years ago, but Montezuma's Revenge, which was ported to a few other platforms, including Master System, that was an early take on open-world exploration, as in Metroidvania.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of single-screen, hunt for treasures, but sort of in the same vein as Spelunker, but more exploratory and a bit less hateful. Still challenging, but not totally kick you in the teeth like Spelunker is. Temple of Apshai and the whole Apshai trilogy were influential RPGs. It's been a long time since I've looked into these games and refreshed my memory on what they were, but I believe they were first-person dungeon crawlers, or were they more like top-down?
Overhead.
Yeah,
they're
okay,
more
top-down.
Kind of roguelike, but yeah, not okay. Exactly. They were very deep too. You had real stats, real equipment, and you're exploring a dungeon that I can't remember if it's procedurally generated or not, but it was, my brother loved Temple of Apshai and the others. So yeah, very cool, very innovative.
And kind of in the same vein, there was Dandy, which is kind of widely regarded as the precursor to Gauntlet. A lot of people have said Gauntlet is just a big Dandy ripoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Ed Logg has admitted that he was inspired by Dandy on designing Gauntlet. So Dandy you can play four players at a time, which is really cool. So it's sort of like a dungeon crawler action game where you have four characters and you can shoot, and there are monsters with generators, and you just get through the level. You try to kill everything, get the food, get the health, get through to the exit. And it is basically like Gauntlet, but with less... less character to it because it doesn't have the fantasy designs of Gauntlet. It's just like a bunch of shapes and stuff.
So it's like if everyone were the nerd from Gauntlet, the Third Encounter, that's what it'd be.
Yeah. It's more like everyone's a square. Everyone's a like a triangle. There's not a lot of detail there. So it's not as exciting as Gauntlet with the monsters and all the
stuff.
But it's still a fun game. You can play four players on it.
I see. All right. We need to wrap this, but one last game. I'd like for you to tell us about Salmon Run because it seems to be a personal favorite, Binge.
Yeah, Salmon Run is cool. It's underrated because I don't think other people would place it high on their list. But the coolest thing about Salmon Run is, well, it was one of the first games I ever played, and it was playable for me as a kid, and it was really fun. You're playing as a salmon swimming upstream to spawn. So you've tried to find your girlfriend at the end of every stage, and you are avoiding bears that try to catch you out of the water and fishermen that try to net you and later birds that try to get you and stuff. And so you're swimming up, avoiding obstacles, jumping up over rocks and upstream. And the coolest thing is the sound effects are so good. It sounds like real rushing water and splashing and stuff. I don't know how they did it, but it's incredible, like the sound effects. And just mixed together, it's a really fun, simple game because all you're doing is swimming and jumping and avoiding, but it becomes a deeper experience because of that.
I'm actually really regretting my opening filibuster now because this turns out to be a really fertile topic. I was, kind of worried about our ability to help Binge give a full in-depth discussion. But yeah, this has been, I think, a great conversation. And really, there's probably enough about the Atari 800 line or the Atari 8-bit line that we can revisit the topic someday and go into further depth and explore other facets of it. But for now, I think it's a pretty good overview. So Binge, thank you so much for bringing all this expertise and personal experience into it. And Ben for the color commentary on the side. I'm glad we have, one more Atari topic under our belts. An area that's often weak on Retronauts. So it's good to get that bit of history. And I don't know, I'm really thinking I need to tackle XEGS as part of the post NES launch console coverage, because it is a console that launched after the NES in America. So technically,
the question is, do you cover the 800, 400 games before it, or do you there's thousands of games for the 800?
Absolutely not. I am not made of infinite time.
Yeah,
and most of them are ports. A whole lot of them, anyways.
The coolest thing about the 800 is the more you dig into it, the more you find just incredible games. It has an amazing library full of titles that have so many neat concepts that could be redone today if more people knew the history. There's just endless fountain of game design ideas out there.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of cool stuff in there looking through the lists.
Yeah, I think the Atari 8-bit line tends to be overlooked in favor of Commodore 64 and Apple II because they were much, bigger and more successful platforms. But yeah, just, reading about this platform and doing some research for this episode, I was really impressed by just the wealth of content there is about, behind this platform. And, Atari really, I think, mismanaged it in a lot of ways, just talking about the ridiculous traffic jam of products they had on the market in the late 80s. It's really, as you said, Binge, they were very reactive and didn't have a plan going forward after a certain point. And it's really a shame because I think it really undercut the long-term legacy of a very rich and successful platform. So I'm glad we were able to at least kind of give it a passing glance here on the show. And hopefully, again, we'll be able to go back someday and talk more about it. But that's it for now. We've all got day jobs and mouths to feed and sort of that sort of thing. Like, I've got my mouth to feed. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I got some.
Yep. Yeah.
So we need to call it a podcast here, but thanks everyone for listening. And thanks again, Binge and Ben. Before we go, we should do our outros. So let me just say that if you, a human being, enjoyed this, a podcast, well, good news, we do these every week and then some. Go to retronauts.com and you can find more, or you can support the show at patreon.com. And by supporting the show, that means you get access to every episode a week in advance at a higher bit rate quality with no ads or cross promotions. And if you put in an extra $2 a month, pay $5 a month, you get all of that plus two additional, maybe sometimes three additional full-length podcasts per month on alternating Fridays, plus mini podcasts every weekend, courtesy of Diamond Fight, and columns that go along with those. And occasionally there's some other stuff we throw in the mix. So, you know, it's a whole smorgasbord of goodness and content and things to put inside of your ears. So that's our pitch. Check us out, patreon.com/retronauts. Keep the show alive. We are crowdfunded entirely. So you, the crowd, keep this show alive and support conversations about video game history, such as this. And bringing on people to talk about game history who are experts, such as Benj. Benj, what's your pitch?
I am Benj Edwards, and I am available on Twitter at Benj Edwards. I'm currently at How To Geek as an associate editor and writing history articles that come out every Monday, I think, at the moment, which is cool. And I want to end by, there's a piece of trivia about the Atari 800 I just remembered. Is it played host to the first four-player simultaneous platform game ever created. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because I want you to do the research. It was created by a very famous game designer before he was famous. So if you find out, message me on Twitter and I want to hear the answer.
Okay. And also, not to downplay your expertise, Ben, but Benj was the pro here. But
absolutely.
You are also an important part of Retronauts East. And where can we find you on the internet?
My name is Ben Elgin. You can find me on Twitter at Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. And I'm sure someday we'll do another podcast on something I'm actually an expert on.
I promise we will.
Yes.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet doing stuff at Limited Run Games, which is my day job, doing stuff at Retronauts. That's this. And also doing my weekly YouTube video series where I don't talk about the Atari 800 or 2600, but I have been covering the 7800, and I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface on that as well. But, you know, the longer I research and read and study, the more I learn, and the better my videos get. So please join me for that learning experience. And finally, you can follow me on Twitter as GameSpite also. But anyway, that's it. That's this episode of Retronauts. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for your support. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining to talk about Atari's old game consoles. And with that, we shall go away and probably play some more video games at some point.